This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. It's 4 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 7 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Coming up on today's programme, the trial of the former president of Catalonia, Artur Mas, got underway in Barcelona today over his decision to hold a symbolic independence referendum in 2014. But with Spain remaining steadfastly opposed to Catalonian efforts to break away from Spain, will mounting tensions spill over into civil unrest? The United Nations has lifted sanctions on Afghan warlord Gulbuddin Hikmatyar. The lifting of the sanctions follows a peace deal that was signed back in September between the Afghan government and Hikmatyar's militant group, the Hizb-e Islami. We look into the consequences of bringing a war criminal back into the political fold. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has called on the UK and Sweden to restore his liberty, citing the UN's human rights mechanisms. Assange has been living in the Ecuadorian embassy since 2012, but recently said that he will return to the US to face charges when the whistleblower Chelsea Manning is released in May. Reports have surfaced that Donald Trump's pick for Transportation Secretary, Elaine Chao, received a large payment to give a speech for an Iranian dissident group that was designated as a terrorist organisation in the US until 2012. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has secured the official nomination as the candidate in the German elections for the Christian Democratic Union and its Bavarian sister party, the Christian Social Union. Leader of the CSU and Premier of Bavaria, Horst Seehofer, said that there is, quote, unanimous support of both parties for Merkel's candidacy. All that and more over the next hour on this Monday edition of World in Focus. The former president of Catalan, Artur Mas, appeared today in Barcelona's High Court over his decision to allow a non-binding independence referendum to take place in 2014. The case adds to a growing sense of tension in the region, with both the Spanish and Catalan governments set for a further showdown in September when new Catalan president Carles Puigdemont plans to hold a second binding independence vote. Mark Hurst has this report.
The sound of thousands of Catalan independence supporters chanting down with Spain's justice system as former Catalan president Artur Mas and former members of his government stood on the steps of the High Court in Barcelona this morning. Mas is facing charges of breach of trust and criminal disobedience for allowing the region to hold a non-binding independence referendum in 2014. The former Catalan leader has insisted he has nothing to apologise for, but the case is being watched closely, not least because the current Catalonian government, led by Carles Puigdemont, has pledged to hold a new binding independence referendum in September. Last week, tensions were further raised when police arrested a number of people as part of a criminal investigation into allegations party officials from Mas's former party, the Democratic Convergence of Catalonia, were involved in corruption. So could the growing political tensions spill over into major civil unrest in the region if the Spanish continue to crack down hard on Catalan independence supporters? Duncan Wheeler is an Associate Professor of Spanish Studies at the University of Leeds, and he joins me now on the line. Dr. Wheeler, how big a risk is there that we could see serious civil and political unrest in Catalonia this year? And what's your assessment of how the Spanish government will respond to that?
Well, I think one of the big problems, the reason we've got to this point is because of the lack of negotiation between Catalonia and a centralised government. I was about to say the Madrid government, which perhaps we shouldn't call it Madrid government, but that's effectively how it operates and how it's seen. But neither side have been very good at not, they've kind of both been flaming, making things more incendiary. And I think, you know, the referendum was one grandstanding gesture, and putting Artur Mas on trial is the response to that. It could easily exacerbate. I mean, the footage this morning of looked fairly peaceful of the demonstrations in Barcelona, but people were coming out onto the streets.
The former Catalan president, Artur Mas, is appearing in the High Court in Barcelona, where he is facing fairly serious criminal charges. He has also accused Spanish authorities of setting him up after a series of recent police arrests linked to an alleged corruption investigation into Mas's former party, the Democratic Convergence of Catalonia. How much should we read into that investigation and the arrests, and do you think they are designed, as Mas has suggested, to damage his prospects during the trial?
The corruption thing is difficult. It's very difficult to talk about, because there does seem to be very little doubt that he has at least been involved in some corruption. The issue is whether he's been unfairly targeted because of, you know, much more so than other politicians. You know, they could argue that for Pepe could sort out their own house first rather than going after people like him. But I think this creates even a huge division within Catalonia, because there's people who, the pro-Catalan sectors, because there's people who think, you know, that he needs to be defended, whatever, despite what he's done. There's other people who think that he should be held accountable for the things he's done, which was one of the reasons he kind of stepped aside at the last elections, was he felt that, you know, the corruption and his bad reputation in that field would affect their electoral possibilities.
And how do you think the outcome of the trial may affect people's attitudes towards Catalonian independence?
I mean, I don't think it will affect it, but I think it will just exacerbate what's already there. It's one of the sad things about recent Spanish politics, is that it's becoming more and more polarised. So be that on left and right, be that on generational terms, or be that on Catalonia versus Madrid.
Latest polling on Catalonian independence suggests that the pro-independence side is still behind, albeit narrowly, in terms of popular support. Do the Spanish government not risk a backlash and increase support for independence if they are seen to crack down too harshly on Mas and his supporters and their efforts to hold a second binding referendum in September?
No, there is definitely that risk. I guess they have the fear of, you know, they don't want, well, I guess they kind of, I think they're also banking on the fact that people, the response to Brexit in Spain was very much the discourse was you can't trust people with a referendum. So I think they're playing with that. And I think their fear with putting a referendum is people might not be pro it, but if you look at when they did the mock, you know, the mock or the false one, however you want to term it, the vote for yes was overwhelmingly won. It was just a question that the turnout was so low.
In the last non-binding independence referendum held in 2014, a large proportion of those eligible to vote didn't. How much of a hindrance is this apparent apathy to the pro-independence side in Catalonia, and does it undermine the defence that Artur Mas and the other former members of the Catalonian government are making during this trial?
I think it does undermine it to a certain extent, but their counter-argument would be, you know, if there's people who don't really, just if people aren't voting, then they don't have a right to have a voice, I think would be their position on it. And you have to bear in mind in Spain, I think much more so than in the UK context, perhaps because it's still a dictatorship, there's a moral kind of judgment associated with not voting that doesn't really pertain in the UK context.
Beyond Catalonia, is there not a risk that by continuing to deny the Catalans a binding referendum that was recognised or would be recognised by the Spanish government, that Madrid will damage its international standing and be perceived as being undemocratic and even authoritarian?
Yeah, I think that's the biggest danger for them. In a sense, when I say Madrid, you know, we have to understand Madrid as shorthand for a series of politicians and forces at play there. But I think that the centralised government of Madrid has that reputation at home. The danger of this reaching a white, you know, through the fuss with this is that kind of the prejudices or the realities, depending on how you look at it, and the way people view Madrid, is that it could become exportable vision, shall we say.
Duncan Wheeler, many thanks for joining us on World in Focus today. Thank you. Well, we're now joined by Dr. Paul Kennedy, a lecturer in Spanish and European Studies at the University of Bath. Dr. Kennedy, how far do you think the Spanish government is prepared to go to prevent the proposed binding second referendum taking place in September?
I think with regard to the Spanish government, I think things are going its own way, really. I think what today is all about is the holding by the inner Catalan region, yeah, of an illegal, even they didn't call it a referendum, they called it a consultation. Yeah. Just trying to follow what's happening today as we speak. Artur Mas, who is the president, I think he's described himself as being, you know, the leading force behind this consultation, is suggesting that he had no idea that the Constitutional Court really meant what they said, and that he wouldn't have gone ahead, sort of, is what he's hinting at, with the consultation, if he'd known that the Constitutional Court really meant its ruling. No, this is absolute madness.
What are the likely scenarios arising from the court case, and how might they influence efforts to hold this second independence referendum? referendum in September?
I think the likely scenario is that, I mean, I personally don't think that Artur Mas has a leg to stand on with regard to this. I mean, what happened was the consultation was held on the 9th of November 2014. Just a few days before, on the 4th of November, Spain's Constitutional Court, and dare I say, even Artur Mas seems to accept that it's incumbent on regions to accept the rulings of the Constitutional Court. It is, after all, Spain's leading court. Yeah? Despite that, he went ahead holding this kind of illegal consultation. He also said, oh, well, it wasn't actually directly organised by us, by the regional government, but there were 42,000 volunteers who were going to, you know, basically organised by the regional government for the consultation. Now, I think they probably will press ahead with yet another consultation stroke referendum, but can I just say one point that I think I should say is that we've had two regional elections and we've had one kind of illegal consultation. None of these has the regional government in Catalonia been able to obtain an overall majority. Now, how many do they need, really, you know, to see that for the region to indicate the backing for independence is just not there? And I would certainly suggest now that the feeling towards independence is going down rather than up.
And is there any risk that if the Spanish authorities progress with what they're threatening to do, which is potentially take control of the Catalan police and close schools, etc., that actually may play into the hands of those who want to see Catalonian independence?
Well, I do think there's very much a sort of victimisation sort of way of looking at this from the Catalan end, really, that, poor us, look what these dreadful brutes are doing in Madrid. I mean, I honestly can't see it like that. I think there's been a relative patience shown from Madrid with regard to what's been happening in Catalonia. It seems that the last thing that the Catalans want to do, or the Catalans who support independence want to do, is to accept that they're flogging a bit of a dead horse here, you know, so that means that they probably will press on. This is difficult for the national government in Madrid. I mean, I'm not a great supporter of the Rajoy's administration in Madrid, but I think he's shown a certain amount of patience so far. I'd be surprised if they were heavy-handed. I mean, I almost think it would be playing into the hands of the likes of Artur Mas or Puigdemont, who is the Catalan president at the moment. I can't imagine them doing it, but this is a very unpredictable situation, and Catalonia is probably the most serious situation, other than the economy, that Spain is facing at the moment.
And could you see the situation developing into something much more serious with civil unrest?
I think that would be going too far. I'd be surprised at that. I mean, I think that that sort of thing would play into the hands of the pro-independence people. I would be surprised if there was sort of a takeover from Madrid of, you know, what you mentioned before, I think, you know, the police and so on in the region. And it is a very ugly situation, there's no doubt about that. But I think that on the basis of today and the ruling and the sort of way that Mas has responded to this, that, oh, I didn't really know it was going to be like this, and I wasn't to know that the Constitutional Court would sort of react in this way. This is madness, you know. This was a unanimous Constitutional Court ruling, which made very, very clear it did not want this illegal consultation to be held. He went ahead anyway.
Dr. Paul Kennedy, a very interesting perspective there. Thanks very much for joining us on World in Focus.
You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It is 12 minutes past the hour. The United Nations has lifted sanctions against Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, the leader of the Hizbi Islami group in Afghanistan. Hekmatyar was one of the most infamous figures in the country's civil war in the 1990s. The decision by the United Nations Security Council came on the heels of the peace deal signed by the government of President Ashraf Ghani and Hekmatyar's group in September. Both the peace deal and the UN decision have been met with mixed responses in Afghanistan, with some people sceptical about the political credibility of a man who stands accused of war crimes. For more on the details, here's Matthew Aiton.
The United Nations Security Council has dropped sanctions against Afghan warlord Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, possibly opening a door for him to return to Afghan politics. The Afghan government requested the United Nations to remove the sanctions in place on Hekmatyar as part of a peace deal with Hekmatyar and his militant group, the Hizbi Islami, that was made in September 2016. Mr. Hekmatyar was a well-known figure during Afghanistan's brutal civil war in the 1990s. He stands accused of sanctioning the indiscriminate firing of rockets onto Kabul, as well as throwing acid in the faces of unveiled women and calling for the imposition of an Islamic State. Mr. Hekmatyar also stands accused of having ties with Al-Qaeda and was put on the US's foreign designated terrorist organization list in 2003. As a result of being removed from the United Nations list of individuals associated with Al-Qaeda and Daesh, Hekmatyar's assets will be unfrozen and a travel ban in place on him will be dropped. While his whereabouts remains unknown, Afghan government officials expect Mr. Hekmatyar to return to the Afghan capital in due course. Back in September, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani signed a peace treaty with Hekmatyar and his group the Hizb-e Islami, which the government hoped would bring other militant fighters, especially the Taliban, into the political fold for peace talks. At the time, the US government lauded the deal as a step towards peace, but some sectors of the Afghan population were much more sceptical. Well, joining me to discuss this in further detail from on the ground in Kabul is Al Jazeera's Ali Latifi. Ali, thank you for agreeing to talk to us here on Radio Sputnik. So firstly, would you say that the United Nations risks normalizing Gulbuddin Hekmatyar by lifting these sanctions, or is it a welcome move?
I mean, it is a welcome move by the government because the government, you know, sees the peace deal as a success and they hope that it can try and prod the Taliban to come to the table. But on the other hand, it's absolutely normalizing him. But we have to remember that the United Nations, the U.S., the EU, the last two Afghan governments, they've normalized all sorts of warlords. I mean, our first vice president at the moment is accused of having detained in public, abused, and even potentially raped a political rival in a northern province, you know, and he and his men are wanted by the Attorney General's office. So they've all been completely normalized. This is nothing new in Afghanistan. You know, we have other warlords who became MPs, who became other vice presidents, or who became deputies to the chief executive, to Dr. Abdullah, who have become ministers, were presidential candidates. This is absolutely nothing new in Afghanistan. And I do think that this is one thing that frustrates people is that, you know, we've constantly been normalizing these people. No one has been held to account. And I think for a lot of people, Hekmatyar, short of the Taliban, Hekmatyar was like the last straw.
As you said there, obviously, Mr. Ghani and his government welcomed this move. But what about ordinary Afghans? Are they, for the most part, concerned about the political return of, or possible political return of Mr. Hekmatyar?
Some people definitely are, you know, some, especially those who lived through the civil war, because it's another figure that is being brought back into the fold. But again, other people, you know, sort of say, okay, we have accepted these, you know, other warlords and we have brought them into the fold. And, you know, why weren't we worried that they would rain rockets over Kabul again? And, you know, they see it as anything to basically end the fighting. And if it brings a peace, then it brings a peace. But there's also, we have to remember that overall, there's very little faith in the government as it is.
So obviously, Ashraf Ghani signed a deal with Hekmatyar and Hizb-e Islami back in September, I believe it was, to, as you put it, bring him and his group into the political fold. But why exactly did he do that? Do you mind just explaining that for us, please?
Basically, Hizb-e Islami became the second largest. We have to remember that there are two wings of the Hizb-e Islami, right? There's the political wing that has been part of the political fold since the Karzai administration, since 2001. And then there was the armed opposition fold, which was still led by Hekmatyar himself, which was until they gave up their guns, they are the second largest armed opposition movement in the country. And ever since about 2009, Afghan government under Karzai and now under Ashraf Ghani have tried to make peace with him. A, because they think it could be symbolic. You know, it could show that, okay, we were able to make peace with one group, and maybe they feel like it could signal to the Taliban. And we have to remember at that event where Hekmatyar signed the agreement via video conference, he said himself, he said, you know, I only signed this after it became apparent that 90% of the foreign forces had left. And I want to remind my Taliban brothers that, you know, they are leaving. Enough of them have left. So what we can do is try and work to restore our country ourselves and take back our political process. And so I would assume that for the government, that's an important statement for someone to try and woo the Taliban in. Whether or not that will actually work, you know, it's highly unlikely. But more than anything, it can be seen as a symbolic victory because this is a man that he's basically been the longest serving, you know, he was a Mujahid leader. He fought the Soviet occupation. And, you know, he was a Mujahid at the time. You know, people respected him and his jihad. And then as the civil war erupted, he and the other commanders, including people who have now become, like I said, vice presidents and ministers and MPs and all of these other things, you know, rained rockets over Kabul, tortured people, kidnapping, detentions and rape and abuse and all of these sorts of things. So he's had a very long history. He's had a very, and then he became part, you know, he was the only one out of them who did not agree to join the government, you know, and he continued his opposition movement. And until about 2012, it was still fairly active. It's become much less active in the last few years. But yes, it was a symbolic win, right? Because he was, you know, they can say, like, we brought him back into the Mujahid fold and we can try and you know, restore his image, and he's basically going to turn away from his other ways.
Yes, but this is obviously a very risky move, isn't it? Because while you might argue that it opens up a more inclusive political space, it also risks giving a voice to a man who stands accused of the most egregious war crimes. And in the end of it all, will the Taliban and other militant groups really pay much attention to it, do you think? In other words, will it really help to rein them in?
I don't think it'll actually have much effect on the Taliban, and that's the thing we have to remember about the Taliban, is that they're no longer one homogenous group. So there's that, and, you know, their leadership does not necessarily exist in Afghanistan, and, you know, they now made inroads with Russia, and they made inroads with China, and they've had long ties, with Iran, so with Russia and Iran, and they, you know, have always had ties with Pakistan and the Arab states. So no, it won't make any difference. Again, like, okay, yes, there's no doubt that he was accused of egregious crimes against the people, but those do some. So was Sayyaf. So was, anyone else. Ismail Khan in Herat, all of these people were. There's, you know, he's not an exception in that way. He's just sort of like, he may be for some people the last straw, if anything.
Well, you mentioned regional powers, specifically Pakistan there, and that ties in nicely with what I wanted to ask you lastly. What do regional powers, in particular Pakistan, make of the peace deal between Ghani's government and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar?
Well, I think the question to ask is, would Pakistan have allowed it? You know, could this have happened without Pakistan's approval? Because we have to remember it was about a year ago where Afghan social media was erupting in anger over an image that showed Hekmatyar's son traveling with Pakistani police, with Pakistani security protection. And so it's clearly obvious that, you know, that something like this would not happen without Pakistan's approval. You know, and what that means about Pakistan's stance is very hard to determine, because it's probably one of the only countries that's more complicated than Afghanistan in that sense.
Sure. Okay, Ali Latif, thank you very much for your time.
No problem.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has called on the UK and Sweden to restore his liberty, citing the UN's human rights mechanisms. Assange has been living in the Ecuadorian embassy in the UK since 2012, but recently said he will return to the US to face charges when the whistleblower Chelsea Manning is released. We'll be back with you in a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me back, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, and muckraker from bradblog.com. Join me for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik, we'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys
when and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast every day, right here on Radio Sputnik.
On Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Tune in.
Well, maybe mention like central bankers and you know, markets are doubling down. Not you're saying everybody's doubling down. They're crazy.
They are. Everyone's crazy.
Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's
novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at SputnikNews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has called on the UK and Sweden to restore his liberty, citing the UN's human rights mechanism. Assange has been living in the Ecuadorian embassy in the UK since 2012, but recently said that he will return to the US to face charges when whistleblower Chelsea Manning is released from prison. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has secured the official nomination as candidate in the German elections for the Christian Democratic Union and its Bavarian sister party, the Christian Social Union. The leader of the CSU and Premier of Bavaria, Horst Seehofer, said there is, quote, unanimous support of both parties for Merkel's candidacy. And what if they brought out an online dating app that matches people not based on their mutual likes, but on everything they hate? We'll be looking at the dating app that's launching just in time for Valentine's Day to do just that. It's 26 minutes past the hour. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, has called on the United Kingdom and Sweden today to restore his liberty in line with the UN Working Group ruling. He said, quote, I call on the UK and Sweden to do the right thing and restore my liberty. These two states signed treaties to recognise the UN and its human rights mechanisms, end quote. Julian Assange has been residing at the Ecuadorian embassy in London since 2012 for fear of being extradited to Sweden. In the United States, he is wanted for leaking thousands of top-secret military documents. Jack Foster has more.
In February 2016, the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention ruled that Assange's de facto incarceration was indeed arbitrary. The UK and Swedish authorities have been refusing to implement the UN Working Group decision since then. Julian Assange, of course, founded WikiLeaks in 2006 and came to global prominence in 2010 following the publication of a series of leaks provided by US soldier Chelsea Manning, who was pardoned just last month by outgoing President Barack Obama. Following the leaks, the United States government launched a criminal investigation into WikiLeaks and asked allied nations for assistance. In November 2010, a request was made for Assange's extradition to Sweden, where he had been questioned months earlier over allegations of sexual assault and rape. Julian Assange continued to deny the allegations and expressed concern that he would be extradited from Sweden to the United States due to his perceived role in publishing secret American documents. With me to discuss this further is a man who's met with Julian Assange on a number of occasions, including late last year, the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan and human rights activist Craig Murray. Thank you for joining us today, Mr. Murray. Now, isn't there an argument that it's Assange himself who's denying his own liberty by effectively refusing to play ball and slowing down the process to the extent that he has?
Well, I think he has a
well-founded fear of persecution. He has a very well-founded fear that he would be shipped off to the United States on espionage charges, although nothing he's done is remotely espionage. So I think he's perfectly entitled to seek political asylum in those circumstances. He's in fact been granted asylum by Ecuador, and he should be permitted to go to Ecuador and enjoy the asylum he's been granted. And that's the position in international law.
Is a lot of that position not based on the assumption, though, that Assange is not actually wanted for these alleged crimes in Sweden, but for, effectively, his involvement in WikiLeaks?
Well, I think, leaving the alleged crimes in Sweden aside for one moment, there's no doubt that there is a sealed indictment against him in the United States on espionage charges. Mm-hmm. That's fairly public, even if not ultimately acknowledged by the American government. So that danger does exist, and it's a danger against which he's been granted asylum. The Swedish thing is a different question, and that's really quite interesting, because for 5 years we were told that the inquiry was held up because they were unable to question him. But they've now completed the questioning, which was undertaken in the embassy in November and could have been undertaken many years earlier. And despite the fact the questioning has now been finished, there are still no charges. He's still been charged with nothing. They've now got all the evidence they're ever going to get, so they must be able by now to assess whether they're going to bring charges or not. And as yet, no charges have been built.
Is there a danger, though, given how polarised the opinion is regarding Julian Assange, that his supporters might be more willing than they otherwise would be to overlook what in any other circumstances would be considered as very serious allegations over a sexual assault? I guess what I'm asking is, if, say, in 10 years' time it transpired that those allegations had been true, would Assange's support base have to take some responsibility for him having evaded justice for so long? And I appreciate this is obviously all very hypothetical. I'm not trying to get at whether the accusations are true so much as the ethical position of writing them off so easily, which I'm not saying that you're necessarily doing, but certainly a lot of Assange's support base are very quick to dismiss.
Well, I didn't dismiss them quickly, but having investigated all the evidence and read all the statements in the case and read all the police files which have been leaked by the police themselves in the case, plainly there is not a very strong evidence base to these inquiries, which presumably is why there are still no charges. And we have to wait and see. My own view is that should he ever actually be charged, that he ought to go to Sweden and face the charges. I don't think there are grounds to make any charges. I don't think that's liable to happen. And as I say, it's now more than 2 months since they, getting on for 3 months, since they had the questioning of Julian Assange. And over the previous 5 years, they've collected all the evidence they're ever likely to have. And yet still no charges have actually been built against him. So, the whole situation with these Swedish charges is blurred, to say the least.
Finally, Mr. Assange famously made a pledge to hand himself over for extradition to the United States in the event that Chelsea Manning would be granted clemency, which of course she was in the 11th hour of Barack Obama's presidency. Though few would seriously argue that that had anything to do with Julian Assange's offer. Given that, though, and given Assange's subsequent assurances that he would stand by that offer, has he any choice now, if he wishes to retain some degree of honour, obviously, than to bite the bullet and hand himself over?
If the extradition case for the United States, if the United States applies for his extradition to the United States, I would say that he would be honoured bound to comply with that extradition request, because he has said that he would. I think, in large part, his offer was perhaps designed to try to flush out the United States, which is attempting to go about this in a rather sneaky way. They haven't ever applied for his extradition. They haven't openly said there are charges against him. And I think what he was trying to do was get all this out in the open and get the situation clear. And that still hasn't happened. We still have no extradition request from the United States. And in the absence of such a request, it's rather futile to discuss whether he should comply with it.
Do you think he'll still be in the embassy 6 months from now?
I think we must be approaching the end game. I think one thing we haven't spoken about, this is the anniversary of the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention's decision that he is illegally detained. And the United Nations Working Group is the senior body in international law that comments on this kind of question and consists of very eminent lawyers. And the failure of the United Kingdom and of Sweden to honour that decision has done real damage to the international law system. And we have seen other states, particularly other states in the Gulf, who have been criticized for arbitrary detention, quoting the United Kingdom as saying that, as showing that that doesn't matter. And so we are setting an example to human rights abusers everywhere. And I think that's the main thing we should be focusing upon.
Well, Craig Money, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
The former British ambassador to Uzbekistan and human rights activist Craig Murray speaking to us there on WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's renewed pleas to the UK and Swedish authorities to, quote, restore his liberty. Jack Foster, World in Focus.
You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 34 minutes past the hour. An official in President Trump's cabinet gave paid speeches for organisations linked to an Iranian exile group that was involved with the killing of Americans before the 1979 Islamic Revolution that toppled the US-backed Shah. Transport Secretary Elaine Chao received $50,000 in 2015 for a speech given to the political wing of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, which has previously been referred to as a, quote, cult-like terrorist organisation by the US State Department. For more, here's our correspondent Matthew Eaton.
It has been revealed that one of Donald Trump's picks for his new administration was paid approximately $50,000 by the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, also known as MEK, an Iranian opposition group that was classified as a terrorist organization by the US until the year 2012. Elaine Chao, who has been confirmed this week as the Trump administration's transportation secretary, was paid by the group for a speech given in 2015. Chao is not the only one in Trump's entourage to be associated with the group. The former mayor of New York City, Rudolph Giuliani, who Trump allegedly briefly considered for the position of Secretary of State and now serves as his cybersecurity advisor, was also paid by the MEK to give a speech. The MEK was formed in the mid-1960s in opposition to the US-backed Shah of Iran. Initially, it supported the Islamic Revolution that toppled the Shah in 1979. However, later on, the group disagreed with the tactics employed by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, and fought on the side of Saddam Hussein's Iraq in the 1980-1988 Iran-Iraq War. The MEK remained in Iraq and allegedly fought against coalition troops after the 2003 Anglo-American invasion. Well, joining me to try and shed some clarity on this is Talha Abdulrazak, a researcher at the University of Exeter's Strategy and Security Institute. Talha, thanks for joining us here on World in Focus. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the MEK, who they are, please?
Well, they started off sort of in the mid-1960s as sort of a Marxist movement, and they were against the Shah of Iran, who obviously predated Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, who was the founder of the modern Islamic Republic of Iran. So they started off very much as an opposition group to the Shah, who was backed by the West, and who was secular leadership and everything like that. So they kind of joined forces with the mullahs in Bahrain, and they were part of the Iranian Revolution in 1979. So up until that point, they were all friends and everything, and everything was all hunky-dory, as it were. But sort of not soon after, when Khomeini started to consolidate power around him and the religious elite, there were clear differences between the two. So whereas the Mujahideen Khalq, the MEK, had sort of Marxist tendencies blended in old fashioned with Islamism, Khomeini's ideology was very much 12 Shiism, Islamism. So there was massive conflicting opinions and differences between them, and ideological differences causing a schism between them. And that caused the MEK organization to actually side with the Ba'athist regime of Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War that began in 1980.
Many analysts have been critical of the support shown to the MEK by Republican politicians in particular, Rudy Giuliani, and more recently Elaine Chao, just to name a few. And why is it, do you think, that US politicians are so happy to engage with a group that was on the US foreign terrorist list until 2012?
Well, there's two facets to this. That's frankly the way politics works in America. So you have many, many different countries who have different lobbying organizations. That includes the Saudi Arabians, that includes the Israelis. The Iranians themselves, during the Obama administration, in fact, they were there with characters like Trita Parsi, who was, a pro-Iran advocate for the regime. He's a lobbyist for Iran. And according to reports by the Washington Free Beacon, former Iranian regime officials and Trita Parsi were invited to the White House, Obama's White House, over 30 times. This happens fairly regularly. When you're looking at a group like MEK cozying up to Republican politicians are actually looking for allies against the regime. So if it was not MEK, it would be someone else. So I don't think, there's anything particularly new here. Like I said, this is the way politics works in Washington. It's all about lobbying. It's all about making the right connections. It's all about gaining the right influence to eventually reach the White House. So the Iranian regime was very successful in that during the Obama period, and now the MEC and other opposition organizations to Iran are trying to take advantage of that on the flip side during the Trump administration.
There are those who have suggested that the MEC might actually work with the Trump administration in its efforts to delegitimize the Iranian regime, and that this might open an entry for them back into Iranian politics. But are the MEC not universally unpopular in Iran, in particular because of their support for Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq war?
I mean, that's right. You know, although one can't underestimate the amount of, you know, oppression and state-backed violence and all the other terrible things that go on inside Iran today, the MEC are in a very bad position in terms of trying to reassert themselves as a popular Iranian force in Iran itself. So although they have quite a following, you know, in foreign countries, particularly France, where they have quite a lot of, you know, concentration of devotees, shall we say, for them to try and ingratiate themselves with the Trump regime and even work with them is a high possibility, but whether they will have any impact on the ground in Iran itself is highly unlikely.
Okay, Talha Abdulrazak, thank you very much for your time.
No problem, you're welcome.
You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 39 minutes past the hour. The German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, has officially been nominated as the candidate for the Christian Democrats and their Bavarian sister party, the Christian Social Union, for the German elections due to take place in September of this year. Just a few short months ago, most commentators would have said that Merkel could hold on to her position without any problem at all. But with the former European Parliament President Martin Schulz leaving the EU Parliament to run against Merkel for the opposition Social Democratic Party, or SDP, she may now have a real race on her hands. A recent Deutschland Trend polling conducted by the German broadcaster ARD shows an 8-point jump for the SDP over the past month. The party still has a long way to catch Merkel's CDU-CSU grouping, but Schulz may be able to become the country's next chancellor, even if the SDP comes second. If the gap between the two parties' results is small enough, and since the victor is very unlikely to secure enough votes to form a non-coalition government, the SDP might have just enough clout to dictate the terms of such an alliance to the CDU/CSU instead of vice versa. Also, if the CDU-CSU proves to be uncooperative, the SDP may instead form a coalition with the Left and the Greens, the so-called Red-Red-Green coalition, which would also effectively result in Schulz becoming a chancellor. Angela Merkel is, of course, in a strong position with the support of her party, but Schulz's running does certainly shake up what had previously been thought of as a foregone conclusion. Germany heads the polls in September, and I'm sure when the campaigning kicks off, you'll be able to keep up to date right here on World in Focus.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, the controversial trade deal between the EU and Canada, the Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, or CETA, has been causing problems for the UK International Trade Minister Liam Fox, who has been accused of burying a parliamentary debate on the subject, with campaigners arguing that he has shown a disdain for democracy. That's all coming at you in a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, Maastricht revolution, imperialism, Maastricht democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
We'll do one together, you ready? Are you ready? Max and Stacey together having oral sex. Here we go. 3, 2. Hi, Stacey.
Double down, double down.
I'm doubling down with you, baby.
Double down.
We got a new show on Sputnik.
It's markets, finance, business, economics, ka-ching, bling, and...
all kinds of good stuff. Only on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Doubling down.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me back, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk programme has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman programme.
Oddly enough, it's not non-fiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Catch all the breaking global political and economic news as it happens. Sputnik brings an all-star lineup with expert opinion from some of the biggest names in the news today. Noam Chomsky.
Turkey, U.S. ally, their main goal is to attack the Kurds, the one ground force opposing ISIS. And there have been a kind of a funnel for support of ISIS, not officially, but in practice.
Peter Sunday, co-founder of the Pirate Bay.
We don't have any sort of democratic control over the internet. And I think that we're very naive when we think that the internet itself is intrinsically good. It's not. It's just a very neutral technology that is being used for good things, but more and more being used for evil things.
Icelandic Foreign Minister Gunnar Bragi Sveinsson.
We increased activities in Keflavik Air Base, and that has to do with more activities from the Russian Northern Fleet in the ocean around Iceland, and also, of course, these usual flights of the bombers.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
We're the ones that destroyed the government of Libya. We're the ones in a pipeline dispute that helped destroy the government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. We're the ones who invaded Iraq.
Former U.S. Secretary of Defense William Perry.
The hostile relationship between the United States and Russia today is dangerous for both countries, not because either country would actually want to start a military conflict, but because there's always a danger of blundering.
Sputnik talks to the brightest minds in politics and current affairs to find out what's really happening. Tune in. Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, the controversial trade deal between the EU and Canada, the Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, or CETA, has been causing problems for the UK's International Trade Minister, Liam Fox, who has been accused of burying a parliamentary debate on the subject, with campaigners arguing that he has shown a disdain for democracy. And what if they brought out an online dating app that matches people not based on their mutual likes, but on everything they hate? We'll be looking at the dating app that's launching just in time for Valentine's Day to do just that. It's 48 minutes past the hour. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. The UK's International Trade Minister, Liam Fox, has been accused of burying a parliamentary debate on the controversial CETA trade deal between the EU and Canada, with campaigners saying that the decision to hold the debate on the same day MPs discuss a Brexit bill shows a, quote, disdain for democracy. For more, here's Jack Foster.
Despite initially promising a full debate on the floor of the House on the matter of the Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, or CETA, the examination of the proposed trade deal will instead be heard by the UK Parliament's European Committee in a smaller conference room. The timing of the committee meeting also coincides with the parliamentary debate over the bill to withdraw the UK from the European Union, which is expected to overwhelmingly attract the interests of lawmakers and the media. Sputnik's Alex Pishilov is with us for more on this. Alex, what is the controversy over the scheduling of the CETA debate then?
Well, the controversy is actually double-pronged. So firstly, critics are accusing the UK's International Trade Minister, Liam Fox, of actually reneging on a promise to hold a full parliamentary debate on the CETA trade deal, which is obviously the proposed deal between the EU and Canada. Now, Fox said in October that MPs would have the chance to have a full debate on the floor of the House. Those were his words exactly. However, it's since been revealed that this won't actually happen, and the debate on the trade deal will actually be taken up by the UK Parliament's European Committee, and that this will actually be held in a smaller conference room rather than in Parliament's main chamber. So that's the first issue, that Liam Fox has reneged on his pledge to hold a full debate. Now, the second concern surrounds the timing of the debate. Now, the discussion will take place at the same time as MPs are discussing and debating the even more controversial issue of Brexit, and specifically the Brexit bill, which will, of course, take the UK out of the European Union. So campaigners are pretty unhappy about this. They kind of see it as somewhat of an attempt to sweep the CETA debate under the carpet while there are far bigger fish to fry. And in this case, the far bigger fish is certainly Brexit. So critics have accused Fox of trying to bury the debate. Well, I actually spoke to some campaigners from the group Global Justice Now, and they've described it as the move as having a bit of disdain for democracy. So, as you can see, it's a pretty highly controversial issue.
But what's the current state, then, of the proposed CETA deal? What are the chances of it actually being ratified?
Yes, well, CETA is kind of sitting in a rather precarious position at the moment, particularly following Donald Trump's win in the US. There's been somewhat of a shift away from these large multinational trade deals like TTIP and the TPP. So as to CETA, it's actually a little bit further along the line to eventually becoming a reality. So the EU and Canada have agreed and have signed the proposed deal back in October, which of course came after some last-minute opposition from the Belgian regional government in Wallonia. Now, however, this doesn't mean that the deal is in place and ready to go. It will go before a vote in the European Parliament on February 15, and if it passes that, then certain aspects of the trade deal will come into place in a provisional sense. However, if the deal is to be applied in full, then it will have to be ratified by all EU member states in their national parliaments and also those relevant regional parliaments, such as a couple in Belgium and in a few other countries in the EU. So while it seems as though the European Parliament will likely vote in favour of the deal later this month, a lot of anti-CETA campaigners are much more hopeful that some EU parliaments might actually vote against the deal, which could ultimately veto the agreement. So at the moment, the deal is still very much in a bit of a precarious position.
Sputnik's Alex Pishilov there speaking to us about accusations that the UK Trade Minister tried to bury a parliamentary debate on the controversial CETA trade deal between the EU and Canada by holding it on the same day that MPs discussed a Brexit bill. Jack Foster, World in Focus.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 52 minutes past the hour. And finally, online dating has become part and parcel of modern life for single people in the 21st century. We all know the way it works and a multitude of services offer to find perfect matches based on the other people who love all the same things you do. But what if there was an app that matched people on everything they hate? Well, for all the cynical singles out there, probably feeling even more cynical with the advent of another Valentine's Day, instead of swiping yes or no to selfies of other local singles, as you do in Tinder, you can now swipe on public figures, activities or concepts that you hate. We asked around in the office to see what Mutual Heights, the World in Focus team, might look for in a partner. Matthew Aiton went with board shorts and Pilgrim's Choice cheese. Jack Foster said annoying ringtones and generally phones that aren't on silent. Mark Hurst's choice might not work out so well as he went with dating sites. And me, well, Jack has tried to guess some things for me. I'm not going to read them all out on air, but he got one right. That's coriander. Absolutely coriander. And perhaps people called Jack. But that's all we have time for in this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget, you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. Until tomorrow, from me, Carolyn Scott, goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Black mayor, black chief of police. I would say the thing that is missing is a black middle class who actually have good manufacturing jobs in the area, which just doesn't exist because of our insane trade policies. We have run up this multi-trillion dollar trade deficit. We buy all this junk from low-wage countries. They end up with our dollars. They don't want to buy anything we make, so they come over here and they buy our buildings and whatnot. You can't have a middle class if you don't have manufacturing.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me back, I will kill myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Hi, this is Max Kaiser for Double Down. New show on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Everybody's doubling down. Central bankers are doubling down. Gambleaholics are doubling down. Everyone's doubling down. Why don't you double down? Right here at Sputnik with a new show called Double Down with Max and Stacey. Bye, y'all.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights, on Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard facts.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Every day we ask questions.
Were you not surprised that somebody executed Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr?
Well, do you see this as being a human rights violation?
Are the cows really stinking up the planet that much?
To move ideas forward.
A gravitational wave is a ripple in the fabric of space and time.
I don't think the launch of the satellite proves anything at all.
Where do good ideas come from? We connect with independent thinkers, hear their ideas, and create stimulating debates on real issues.
The Dow is in a correction. As I said, commodities across the globe are collapsing. Why is that the case? Because we are in a global recession.
That is set to change because Iran has approximately about 50 million barrels, which it had put in storage during the height of the sanctions regime, and that's ready to be released as soon as possible.
Where is the money?
The super rich individuals and the world's biggest companies are able to hide money in tax havens.
Is there a solution to the crisis?
No, because I don't think anything useful has come out of any of the policy reform discussions with respect to financial reform.
They give us answers we aren't always prepared for.
This recession will be even worse than it was in 2008.
But that would be the nasty way for it to happen, you know.
But because of Guantanamo, the U.S. is no longer taking so many prisoners. So instead of taking prisoners, they kill people.
They aren't always prepared to answer.
What are the exact technicalities of this offer by the European Union to Turkey, Jim?
I just love the way you ask that question. What are the technicalities of an EU offer? The answer is, of course, a classic EU fudge.
Well, I'm a diplomat, Jim. You know that.
Absolutely.
Welcome to the show.
Hello, Abdul. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm smiling.
How are you?
Thank you very much. Pleasure talking to you.
Always a pleasure talking to you as well.
Hello, Abdul. How are you?
I'm fine. Hello. Although the views which I express are not necessarily the views of the editors, but one thing you will agree with me.
You know, with that said, we've had our fun, I guess. Is it time to get serious?
So you think we really should take this warning 100% seriously?
Welcome to the party.